Hello all. I would like to welcome everyone to Capital Link's Shipping Sector Webinar Series. My name is Nils Thomassen. I work for Fearnley Securities, and I will be today's moderator. This webinar will focus on the crude tanker sector, discussing sector trends, developments, and outlook. Two quick remarks before we start. Disclaimer that these webinars are for informational and educational purposes only and do not constitute investment advice or advice of any kind. You can submit your questions during the session using the button at the bottom of your screen. We can email them to questions@capitallink.com. These questions will be addressed at the end of the panel discussion, and your questions should be sector-focused. By the way, this webinar will be available as a replay later for those who would like to access it on demand. Now, I have the pleasure to introduce today's panel. We have Mr. Harry Kosmatos, who is the CFO of SACOS. We have Mr. Svein Moxnes Harfjeld, who is the President and CEO of DHT Holdings. Aristidis Alafouzos is the CEO of Okeanis Eco Tankers. And last but not least, we have Mr. Kenneth Hvid, who is the President and CEO of TK Corporation. And then I think before we start with the panelists, I'd just like to address the market backdrop. If you look at share prices, it seems like this cycle is over and that the sky is falling down. Perhaps it's not that easy, but it's clear that soft oil demand from China, lower production growth from the Atlantic, and the dark fleet taking market share has impacted the tanker market negatively this year, even though you have ton-mile growth and fleet growth that matches each other. And then we haven't seen a reversal of the OPEC production cuts yet, which obviously hasn't helped on sentiment. And I think with the backdrop of VLCCs being the most disappointing on the rate side, I want to start with the panelists with the most exposure there. We got quite a bullish backdrop today from the IEA with non-OPEC production growth of 1.5 million barrels for next year and good oil demand. But Svein, is this enough to create a bullish outlook for VLCCs next year, or do we need more than that?
Six Sven is on mute.
Yeah. Okay. Not just me.
Sorry. Now
I hear you.
Yeah. I think it's really the last few weeks that has been very, very soft. But the year as a whole has not been very bad. We made 50,000 average spots on our sort of average age 10-year-old fleet for the first three quarters, and I think the beginning of our fourth quarter was also quite robust. But in my view, China is the elephant in the room, and OPEC's sort of position is partly reflected on lackluster or disappointing demand in China. But of course, also a reflection that they have essentially financed Atlantic-based producers by holding back barrels. So they have a sort of a very tough position now. They're between a rock and a hard place in are they going to focus on market share or going to focus on price? I think it's very difficult for them to have both. But to China, they have been drawing inventories, and of course that is in general not good for transportation because it means that the refiners are buying less than what they actually consume. So we need to get into a position where you start to rebuild inventories, and at some point that will happen. It's a question of time. The stock market, of course, now is I think is impacted by some fear, and sometimes that is amplified by all the news and all the things going on more than actually the fundamentals. I think that it's very difficult for China to not do anything, and we have seen this. So last week they stated that they will implement economic policy with what they called moderately loose. And the last time they had this statement for economic policy was in the period between 2008 to 2010 after the financial crisis. I think that's actually quite, so it's a very powerful statement. And also today they came out with further news on more stimuli to get consumption growing. So this, of course, is not working the day after the statement, but I think it demonstrates very serious intent from China to get the economy going. And that's really what we need. So, as a company, we are patient. We can afford to be patient. We have very low leverage, very low break-even levels, and are comfortable. And I think if you have a weak patch like now, maybe there will be opportunities also, right? So we will stay patient.
So, China demand, Aristides, so do you agree that that's the big risk for 2025, or are there other grayish clouds on the horizon that you are seeing?
Thank you, Niels, and thanks for inviting us to Nikos. I think Svein recapped the issues very well of why the market's been weak in Q4. I guess we started feeling and sensing that the market had a bit of instability when, you know, over the summer we started seeing refinery margins really come off quite a bit, and it became unprofitable for refiners to refine crude, and they started importing less. And in addition to that, although the beginning of the half, as Svein mentioned, the year was excellent, and we had nice strong rates, it tailed off in the second half. And I think if you look closely at long haul ton miles, or like ton miles and like long haul voyages, as the year progressed, these came off as well. And I think that like that's the evidence of China being weak and affecting crude arbitrage opportunities, and being able to move crude long distances from the China from the Atlantic basin, like U.S. Gulf or Brazil, all the way out to China. So, China has unfortunately been the big issue for us, and I think you can see it across all sectors, right? I mean, anything that's energy related that floats is having a really weak Q4, other than LPG, which I guess it's still quite bad, but whether it's capes, LNG, tankers. So, I mean, it's quite obvious that it's China being the weakness, which is such an important market for our business to be strong in.
But then if we move over to the mid-size sector of crude, Harry, Tsakos has a significant exposure to mid-size crude. And we've seen that there's been an outperformance over the past years, and that's also continued into Q4. And right now we have rates that are, quite strong. So, what do you see as the reason for the outperformance, and do you expect that trend to continue into next year?
Thank you, Niels. Well, obviously we have seen some notable activity in that side, in that vessel sizes, particularly in the Mediterranean and the shorter voyages that do not travel through by the VLCCs. They're more versatile vessels. They are the ones that carry the balance from they're more flexible from West Africa to the US, and then the other way around. US crude oil exports are on the increase, that these are carried on longer term basis on the Suezmax vessels. So we have seen some sustained developments in that market. This is a sector that cannot really get cannibalized by the VLCCs. They are, they operate primarily in shorter term voyages compared to what a VL like in a super long haul trade. So this enables owners to, in a way, to have enough vis-à-vis the charter risk in getting cut on higher risk, healthier rates to what the VLCCs were getting. But I think it's very important to echo what Svein said earlier. I mean, everyone's talking about the recent kind of drop in freight rates across the board. VLs and Suezmax and Aframax have seen primarily this drop in spot voyages. Time charter rates continue to remain firm. There is demand both the vessel classes that primarily operate for Suezmax and the Aframaxes. The majority of our vessels operate in longer-term contracts. Example, certain provisions, and we are seeing demand for this kind of tonnage, for the voyages that I mentioned, cross-med in Far East, and a lot of activity, from the US Gulf, and you know, again, sometimes the workforces of the industry, and I think this would be like the last to get impacted from, you know, any sustained pressure in the market, which, in all fairness, we cannot expect this to be the case taking the long term out, because we're all both receive this and Spain mentioned and obviously Union as well with the Chinese Chinese demand that's driving, you know, the current situation today and the softening in oil imports, perhaps reflecting a lower consumption. Coming out of COVID, we haven't really seen the acceleration of oil consumption from the Chinese, but it's we feel this will eventually get streamlined and considering that the market fundamentals are still in our favor, considering, you know, we have and we're still relatively low and look a great number of vessels over 50 years of age. We do not believe that even this sustained Chinese reduction of oil imports could destabilize the market, at least in the near term.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, Kenneth. You are also, you know, big on mid-sized tonnage. Are you seeing any other sort of positives for your vessels, particularly that, you know, should continue to drive the outperformance in 2025?
Yeah, I do actually. I think it's the way we look at it is it really is the starting point in 22 with the invasion and what started there. And I think when we came into 22, we already had a fairly balanced fleet. So we were actually quite optimistic about where the market was going. But clearly that got amplified when we started seeing the sanctions taking place. And I think when you look at the reason for the outperformance, it really comes down to just the rapid ton-mile demand for Russian barrels that really just pushed the development. And if you look at it fast forward to today, I think we have about 467 vessels that's gone into the dark fleet, right? And that is 27% of the medium-sized tankers if you take Aframaxes and Suezmaxes and include LR2s in that. So clearly we've had a lot of cargoes that have gone longer haul into China. And I actually think that also partly explains why the VLCCs have been underperforming, because I think it's really a matter of the V's underperforming as opposed to the Aframaxes and Suezmaxes outperforming. And if you look at the Chinese imports, they imported about 30% of their volumes on gray dark fleet vessels, right, from Russia, from Venezuela, and from Iran. So clearly those are the volumes that ideally would come from OPEC countries and be traded on these. So I think that's the main reason for it, of the outperformance. And I think a lot of it comes down to, will this last? Well, right now, I think the Aframaxes and the Suezmaxes are performing relatively well. The expectations from everybody when we sat in the middle of the summer for Q3 and Q4 was that we'd see a much stronger winter than we are currently experiencing. And that goes for, I think, across, as other people have said, across all asset classes, the expectations were quite high. And as the analysts returned from vacation, you started waking up and realizing, wow, Q3 was not turning out exactly as people were hoping for as we were sitting there in the summer. So we saw a lot of the estimates coming down, and then the numbers were coming out. And I think as we were looking at the Q4 and we looked at where we were a year ago, October was the big trigger point in 2023. There was a bit of life in October this year. For some segments, the market came down again. I think for Aframaxes and Suezmaxes, stayed relatively flat. But we're not seeing the levels that we saw a year ago, but it's still very healthy levels, right? So the big question is, will we continue to outperform, as you said? And a lot of that really comes down to what happens next on the Russia situation, the unwinding of the of the grey fleet, and will it ever unwind, right? Because the biggest issue I think we have around the grey fleet is, of course, it's a very old fleet, so most likely we're not going to see that flow back into the conventional fleet again. And if that doesn't happen, then we could have a quite a healthy market for quite some time.
Mm. Yeah, and you introduced the topic of... Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, may I interject, because Kenneth made some excellent points here, and I think it's very important to stress and highlight, especially if we have investors in the audience looking at the situation, trying to make an assessment. I think it's very, very important to realize that the majority, and this is kind of a game changer, the majority of the dark fleet are Suezmaxes and Aframaxes. Older tonnages that effectively have gone over the fence. Somehow supply from the Western, if you like, markets that we operate and everybody else operates. So we are suddenly, or over the last couple of years since the invasion of the Ukraine, in a situation of a global rise in oil demand, the vessel supply leaving them with the other side. So we have seen the bifurcation of the market, the trades that we operate, the lagging vessels, and the majority of the vessels being those with size tankers. So effectively, are running at the full utilization to try to service the needs of the global trades. So relatively limited supply to carry an increase in demand for oil barrels. So I think this is very important to highlight. And those vessels that have slim size and have gone over the fence, they're not coming back, because we're talking about substandard older vessels that have been tainted. Even if they were rented tomorrow, they're not coming to compete with us. So even though on paper, people might seem that we have potentially could be enough vessels to carry the cargo, in reality, they will not, because effectively these vessels will depart. The local trades will be scrapped eventually. But the healthy Western trades could potentially see more negative growth on Suezmax or Aframax, depending on the delivery schedule and the increase of their global volume. So overall, a net positive impact for operating in this sense.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, the panelists have introduced the topic of the dark fleet was part of the next questions I had. I thought I'd start with you again, Kenneth, because, well, at least to my knowledge, you're the closest to the White House physically of the panelists. Trump 2.0, I guess, positive in terms of pro-energy and harsh on Iran. But then as you talked about the Red Sea and Russia specifically, had a positive impact on tankers overall. So how do you see sort of the coming 12 months with Trump coming into office and perhaps also longer term in terms of the impact on tankers?
Yes, I think what we're all wondering what's going to happen. Overall, I think there's broad agreement that a Trump administration is probably positive for energy. So I think over the longer term, we're probably going to see more barrels being produced in the US and possibly also exported. As we all know, that takes time, so it's not like you don't flick a switch and then it's on. But overall, I think it's a positive longer term fundamental. I think the one that everybody is debating at the moment is the kind of the short term impact, especially if there is a 25% tariff on imported barrels, of course, from Canada, since I'm based in Vancouver, that's a big focus there. And how realistic is that? And we don't know, of course, but what we do know is that the US imports about 4.1 million barrels a day from Canada. I think that's about two thirds of all of the barrels that the US is importing. And of course, a lot of that is refined and goes out through the US Gulf refineries. So if for any reason that flow was reduced, then you think that the US Gulf refineries would start importing those barrels from other places, which of course would be a net positive for shipping. But having a view on whether there will be an import tariff or not on Canadian barrels, well, I guess we'll just need to wait and see.
Mm. Yeah, and Svein, one of your peers have been very vocal on the dark fleet. You know, what's your take on the impact? I know it's difficult to quantify, but you know, from one thing is the ton mile impact on Iran, Iranian volumes going to China instead of, for instance, from Saudi. But is there also a psychological impact there that you know that the dark fleet is there, and when sort of sentiment goes against you, like it has now, does that just add to the negative sentiment, or is it sort of embedded in the physical market?
I think sentiment is more a factor. You know, the majority is in the capital markets, but of course, in the spot market, sentiment might, you know, if it's finely balanced, it does play its part, either bringing the rates up or down. The VLCCs that are, you know, say in the shadow fleet, is about 130 of them plus minus. It is a meaningful portion of the fleet. I do think that just from a geopolitical perspective that, and you read this in the papers every day, as you know, Iran's hand in general terms is weakening. And I would be surprised to see if the US does not take this opportunity to try to weaken that regime further. I think the consequence for us will be that, you know, a lot of those barrels going out of Iran will have to be replaced by likely other producers in the Middle East. I don't think it's a one for one because the sanctioned fleet or the shadow fleet is very inefficient. I think in best case, the productivity is 50% of conventional ships. So I think you can look at sort of 1-2 ratio there. Yeah, that's really my comment on the sanction part. When it comes to tariffs, I have a little bit of a hard time to believe that tariffs will play a meaningful part in the oil market, because one thing, if you have sort of shore-based factories and goods and things like that, this that you move around, but the oil is a truly global commodity, and there are many alternatives, as really this war with Ukraine and Russia showed us, that you know, people will get oil. It's just a question of from where. So I don't think it's so realistic to say that suddenly we will put, or that China will put tariffs on US crude, for instance. I think that's highly unlikely. So in my view, I think these tariffs is more of a negotiation game. And I think the incoming president, he sort of put his stick way into the opponent's yard, right? To sort of start his talks, hopefully he thinks in his favor. I think this can sort of be a good thing for the energy sector.
Hmm. No, that's good intel. And I think moving over to a bit on asset prices, because we're seeing signs that things are coming down, which is natural where rates haven't been moving. And starting with you, Aristides, you sort of have a quite a narrow mandate with, you know, eco-modern vessels, and considering, you know, the pace of the new buildings prior to 2020 and the last couple of years as well. You know, there's not too much to go by, but let's say there are candidates for sale at the 5-10% below the current level. So, you know, are you tempted to add exposure in VLs and Suezmaxes, or are you, you know, you want to see more from China before you are comfortable adding capacity to the fleet?
Well, since we listed, Okeanis has basically stated, and like we've been consistent, that it wasn't really a vehicle to grow. It was more of a dividend type of structure where we'd pay out, and at some point we'd, you know, potentially sell the fleet or time charter the fleet or find some way of locking in some earnings. So the main interest would not be to grow the fleet right now, even if there is interesting opportunities. Although, like, I mean, when the share was trading as it was, and all the shares, you know, above any of the people on this call, maybe there could have been an accretive deal we could have done, and but, you know, we do have a lower liquidity, so it's not as easy as a company like DHT or Frontline for us. But the main goal, no, it wouldn't be to grow. And I mean, I think one of the core beliefs we have is that we don't want to disturb like the dividend paying potential we have by having to either, you know, lever up or use our cash to pay for new ships to come in. So we're quite happy with the size of the fleet. I mean, luckily it's young and yeah, so pretty good overall. I just want, if it's okay, I want to add one thing about the discussion earlier. I had raised my hand, but I don't think you noticed. I think what Harry and Kenneth were saying about the Aframaxes and the Suezmaxes, I think the strength in the Aframaxes and the Suezmaxes because of the Ukraine war was so strong and the impact was so heavy, like it was so focused on these two segments and not on the VLCCs, that you actually had VLCCs, like this is a bit of a contrast to Harry's view, but like seriously cannibalizing a lot of the Afra and Suez trade. Like privately, we also own Aframaxes. In OAT, we have Suezmax as well. So at some point over the past 2 years, you know, us and many other companies, I mean, DHT as well, we were fixing basically the same rate on in a lump sum basis to move one Afra cargo from the US Gulf to Europe as a VLCC. We were moving, you know, 2 million barrels and the Afra was moving 700,000 for basically the same, the freight. Now the charter obviously had more inefficiencies because he might have to do multiple discharge ports. So the cost to the charter was more on the VLCC. So that's why he couldn't freight it the same way. And you saw the same thing in West Africa, like TD20, which is the standard WAF to Europe route using Suezmaxes. We saw that VLCCs were so weak and Suezmax were so strong that you would offer in a VLCC at half, you know, half the rate to take double the cargo, and you were able to compete. So you saw Europe, especially, which was not really a big VLCC receiving region, starting to be a lot more flexible. You saw charters co-load, so you'd have like one charter, you know, two receivers discharging, whether it was Exxon and Total, and they would work together in order to move barrels cheaper on a dollar per ton basis from the US Gulf to Europe and also from WAF to Europe. So that was a development which took pressure off the Afras and Suez, and the market for them would have been even higher, but luckily it did help the VLCCs quite a bit. And it created this new market in the West, which a lot of these listed companies and Western owners took advantage of, because for a big part of the past 2.5 years, you were able to command a premium by either trading your ship in the West or in and out of the West.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. And we can leave the asset values aside for a bit more, because we got the question on the chat, sort of why crude went into product. Now, I know you, Aristides, you were taking a part, a large part in that, cleaning up your VLs. But do you see sort of a structural shift now that there is less inefficiencies and less volatility, so you don't really have these opportunities to, let's say, cannibalize or benefit from the other other segments? Or do you expect that there will, you know, continue to be much more volatility going forward as well?
Well, I mean, I generally think that U.S. Gulf to Europe, if Afras are very weak and Suez are very weak, you will see more Afras and Suez doing this trade rather than VLCCs, because there's a few receivers which can take a full VLCC cargo. Otherwise, they need to do an STS or do two-port discharge, and these complications cost money. And you can have simplicity if rates are cheaper on the Afras and Suez. So, you know, in a very weak Afra and Suez market, maybe the VLCCs have less business for the US Gulf TA. And the same goes from the WAF up. Now, for us, the cleanups, we had no interest to move clean products. I don't think anyone else did. It was just a question that we had a bunch of ships coming out of dry dock. We had a bunch of ships we fixed to the east to kind of take advantage of this late spring, early summer market. And they were opening up in the east, which is somewhere we don't generally like to trade on the classic TD3 run. And we thought of a way that we could find a backhaul, which we love, to come west. And also, because you're loading clean, you need to STS on the load, STS on the discharge. You always have delays. So the voyage, instead of maybe being a standard crude backhaul of 70 days, would go 85, 90, 95. Demurrage is always higher than your time charter equivalent as well. So we thought that this would put a great way to get us into Q4. And then we got into Q4 and we were earning less, unfortunately, than we were on the backhaul. So that was a bit of a bummer. But yeah.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. And I think, moving back to asset values then, we have probably a drop ahead of us. Kenneth, you've been vocal about fleet renewal. Is this a silver lining for TK?
In some ways, it probably is. I think the wonderful thing about the different companies here and age profiles is that people are solving for different things, right? There are different mandates that we have. And of course, TK has been around for 51 years. We started out in Aframaxes. We're still in the medium-sized tankers. We're a company that always solving for the next 50 years and trying to figure out, well, how do we position ourselves as an operating company? And with that, I mean, for us, it's about being integrated both on technical and commercial, right? So when we think about how to go in and out of the market here, we're always there with an owner's mindset that we always need to have a core fleet. And of course, we're looking for opportunities to renew it at the right time, but we're also always looking at it from a point of trying to maximize the returns. And not surprisingly, I mean, we've been quite focused in the last 10 years on having a slightly older fleet because we think the return on invested capital when the market really hits is superior to owning the younger fleet. And when you look at kind of the hand that we were dealt in the beginning of 22 and the position we had, I mean, we of course, we didn't know it was going to be this strong, but we kept all our ships in the spot market, essentially. And when you look at what that has done for the past 3 years in terms of transforming a balance sheet, the free cash flow generation you get when you're 100% spot in this market, it's been truly transformational, right? But at the same time, our fleet has gotten a bit older, but we still have significant operating exposure. We have 41 tankers that we own, and then we have a couple of in charters, and they're still just shy of 15 years on average. So we have a bit of time to get the renewal of the fleet started. Obviously, you don't want to renew at the highest point in the market. So, in some ways, sitting here and seeing some softening is a positive. I think the new build prices could have plateaued. We've seen a correction downwards, probably in response to the lower underlying market that we've seen in Q3 and Q4 so far. And if that continues into the next summer here, then yeah, there'll probably be a window for some gradual renewal of our fleet. But our focus is really just trying to have the lowest break even, make the highest free cash flow, highest return on invested capital of the fleet we have. And that's where we find that the current fleet profile we have gives us a lot of operating leverage.
And then over to you, Harry. I guess your mandate is a bit freer, let's say, than the other panelists, whether it's products, crude, VLs, mid-size. What's Tsakos looking at these days as the most attractive growth vertical for their fleet?
Well, as you know, we are kind of operating or owning vessels across all vessel sectors from the very large crude carriers down to the smaller handysize product tankers and everything in between. So the reason of this fleet diversity is effectively us trying to meet the demand from our clients. So it's not necessarily us deciding we have so many VLs, so many Aframaxes, because we in a way, we are a little bit different to the excellent companies on this panel, and we adopt the more kind of industrial approach, the longer term contracts. We're building vessels against long-term contracts for the needs of the likes of Exxon, Equinor. So we do not really, in a way, we try to if you like, assume the cyclicality of the market for the benefit of our shareholders and the longevity of the company. So we are in a way guided by our clients. So if XYZ client wants Suezmaxes, we're going to build Suezmaxes. If they want Aframax, we're going to build Aframax. So it's not necessarily up to us. Now, if it was down to us on what vessel sectors we would like to to kind of beef up our presence. I would probably say, you know, we like the VL. We feel a company of size needs to have a little more presence in that sector. We like the, you know, in a way, the, I wouldn't say the volatility, but the flexibility that that a VL could offer in a company like Ten, this is an area that if it was down to us, we would like to see opportunities that would come from that investor class. You know, over the last 2 years, we still view the company as a growth company, despite having, you know, 74 vessels, former fleet of 74 vessels, 12 of which are new buildings under construction, so 62 vessels in the water. So over the last 2 years, we have sold 13 vessels, again, from, you know, LNG, Suezmax, Aframaxes, and we have replaced those vessels. We have replaced them and acquired additional tonnage of approximately 2.3 million deadweight. So we have sold, given the statistic, 1 million of deadweight, and we have acquired or built 2.3 million deadweight. So we're always looking at opportunities. You may have seen that last year we acquired a small Norwegian company, Fleet, the Beacon Fleet. So again, it was fleet that we kind of like because of its modernity, because of the dual fuel element on a couple of the LR2s. It's as much stuff amongst the kind of vessels that, that we love to operate. So in a way, it's a kind of a case-by-case basis. Also on the side sectors, on the side kind of energy classes like LNG potentially, or some tankers. These are vessel classes that in a way provide some. We see it as a stabilizing kind of factor on the cash flow generation of the company because of the longevity of the contracts that we attain. In a way, we see them as an annuity investment rather than an investment that will basically kind of follow the market and be exposed to the cyclicality of the market. All in all, you know, we are kind of indifferent, generally we like the crude side and the larger vessel classes, and we're also looking to divest some of our let's call it first generation vessels. In theory or in practice, for that matter, any vessel that is in the low teens, it's kind of a candidate for sale. So we would be looking to offload a few of our first generation vessels, ideally within the first half of 2025. And if an opportunity arises, replace them with similar kind of units.
All right. Yeah, we also got a question from the audience, which is interesting. And as you know, you, Harry, liking VLs perhaps the most. We have two VL companies on the panel, more mainly VL. And you know, the valuation has come down, you know, very steeply, and now you're trading at quite significant discounts to NAV. And you know, both DHT and Okeanis are paying sort of 100% of EPS. So you know, what does it take for you to initiate buybacks? It's an open question to Svein and Aristides.
So we have done buybacks in the past, but let me just take a step back. So I think we are clear-minded about how you allocate capital, and this is the core question. And for a shipping company, in my view, there's sort of four uses of that capital. You can pay dividends, you can buy back stock, you can buy ships, or you can repay debt. And it's a question, you will have to do different things at different times. Some things you will do all the time. When we introduced our dividend policy to pay out quarterly cash dividends equal to 100% of earnings per share, we did this with a very, you know, clear structure that our cash break even is meaningfully lower than our P&L break even. That means that we generate what we call internally as sort of discretionary cash flows after dividends that we can use for the three other purposes than dividends. And when we bought back stock in the past, it's been more opportunistic, and it's been in addition to paying dividends. And we thought about it more like buying ships. So when there's been a sort of big dislocation between asset values and the share price and the trajectory, expected trajectory of the market, we've bought back quite a lot of stock. So an example is in 2021, we really wanted to invest a lot buying modern secondhand ships, but we really only found the two good opportunities. So then the market was again, here's a dislocation in share price and asset values. So we bought back almost 6% of the company, equal to an additional 2.5 VLCCs. And you know, these are, so it's very much on our mind to try to look at these things to maximize value at any given time. So it's not off the table, and we will tell the market if we buy back shares.
And obviously this, you know, you have a bit of a higher cash break even, I guess. So buying back shares would probably you know, be an alternative to dividends and not both with Svein and DHT. But you know, what do you need to see to do some buybacks?
Look, I mean, over the history of the company, we've done some buybacks, but I think like a cumulative amount has been, I don't think it's more than 10 million. So from the more traditional, let's say, Greek DNA, we give the dividends to shareholders, and if they want, they can buy back the shares themselves. I mean, you know, unless there's some extreme discount where you have a strong freight market and really weak capital markets, okay, there maybe we would do some aggressive buyback. But for the time being, we're happy just to give dividends and let the shareholders decide. And yeah, we do have a slightly higher break even than DHT, but in line with Frontline, or lower than Frontline. But we also have the youngest and most efficient fleet, and we've been managed to be outperforming since we've listed. So we feel that outperformance is a decent buffer, and it's actually realistically lower than just that round number.
And in your bigger picture, we've had a good bull run, you know, across all the asset classes. And then I guess the question is it more to come? And you know, with perhaps some owners being satisfied with what's been, does the current weakness in the market open up for more M&A? Do you expect more M&A to come on the back of this, let's call it the blip in weakness? That's an open question for the panel. Svein, your hand is up.
Happy to have a go. I think it's rare to really see true M&A, or you know, public to public M&A in the shipping space. There, of course, have been deals, but it's not as common as you might see in some other industries. We've done two large deals in sort of in our time, but they have both been taking private fleets into the public space. And that is very difficult when, of course, the shares are trading below asset values, because you cannot expect a private owner to sell his assets at a discount to market value. But of course, if you have dislocation or differences in discounts or premiums, it should be possible to do things in the public space. But you also have today a quite sort of fragmented, you know, group of owners with very different fleet profiles or sizes or ages, leverage, corporate governance, a lot of these things. And you know, many of these things tend to be hurdles to actually do deals that could otherwise be accretive to or for shareholders. So, and then in addition, there are, you know, this is also an industry where you have some egos every now and then, right? And the social issues could also be a sort of a stumbling block. So I think in general that sort of is the reason why there's a limited number of transactions being done.
And Kenneth, I see you also have your hand up.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with everything that Svein said. I think it's quite difficult given the public landscape that we have right now, or the public tanker companies. There's not a lot of obvious combinations, but I think there's always owners that come into tanker ownership with a different mindset. I mean, we have still a number of players that are buying assets to flip them, and obviously that's a very interesting business model as long as the asset values are going up. But if we are entering into a phase now where we're seeing some softening, I do think that we could see different interests of selling and stepping out of the segment again. It's not long ago that the tanker market broadly wasn't the most appealing investment space to be in. And if you look at all of the shipping segments, and you kind of take the 2050 curve, I think we're the only shipping segment that's actually not growing over the next 25 years. We're actually dropping at some point, and it's anybody, we may be on a panel like this 10 years from now, and we'll say, wow, we're wrong again. But right now, I think at some point, we expect oil demand to plateau and decline. And I think if you enter a backdrop again where you're going to see a slowing need for or reduced need for transportation of barrels, then you probably see a different competitive landscape again. And I think that's going to drive opportunities for the people that that will be there to the very end, and that creates some new opportunities, I think. But there's no doubt about that. When a market is firing on all cylinders, you attract a lot of new capital that comes into the market. You build ships, you order ships to hopefully flip them, and sometimes you get it right, and sometimes you get a little bit caught in terms of, and then you need to decide that you're going to flip them or you're going to operate them, right? So I think there'll be opportunities.
Yep. Interesting comments from the both of you. We've got another question from the audience, which we haven't really discussed in terms of scrapping trends. You know, to some extent, also depends on what happens with dark fleet. But you know, the fleet age, the tanker space has been discussed in many forums. Let's not take the whole story here. But you know, with the current market not being as good as many had hoped, are we going to see more scrapping in 2025? Assuming that that current rates hold, or are you know, ship owners cash rich and can allow themselves to wait a couple of years? Again, an open question here. And Svein, your hand is up.
I'm happy to have a little go at it, at least. I think, you know, the majority of the ships that today are, at least from an age perspective, maybe also from a technical condition perspective, are candidates. They are in the shadow fleet. And I understand from some of the sort of big yards that typically recycle ships, they have a challenge now to establish acquisition financing due to KYC issues, buying ships that have been in some of these trades. So it's a bit prohibitive. You do see, you know, demolition activity in other sectors where you haven't had that influx of sanctioned business. But I'm a little bit afraid that we could have a sort of an environmental disaster here by having a lot of ships being anchored around the world, becoming obsolete, but not being recycled or you know, taken apart. And maybe even without knowing the identity of the owners, nobody being responsible. So at some point, I do think we need you know, global authorities in a way, through maybe the World Bank or similar, to organize proper financing to actually get recycling going. And this is a big environmental task. I think that the challenge is maybe much bigger than most people involved in sort of thinking about the environment think about. So at least I would like to put that out there, that this is maybe a very important task for the industry. Today, people are only talking about should we have LNG or ammonia or methanol. And frankly, so far, it's a bit of rubbish. And it's a lot of talk, right, for what we do. This is much more important, I think.
Aristides, any thoughts on scrapping for next year or and the year's beyond? You're on mute.
Sorry, I agree with Svein. Overall, I think that other than scrapping, like, you can consider ships moving into the dark fleet as, you know, effectively being removed from ships that anyone in this panel competes with. And I do see a scenario where there could, on the VLCC side, where there could be a large demand for older ships, where, like, these new appointees for the Trump administration have been quite outspoken about saying that they do want to limit the foreign currency into Iran. They want to limit their oil exports. Iran is weak and has had, you know, two huge defeats this year. So it seems like a good opportunity. And if the United States is able to pressure China into reducing Iranian exports, all of a sudden you have Iran producing oil but not being able to sell it. And I think we've seen, especially during COVID, that the last thing a producer wants to do is shut down as well due to the difficulty in reopening it. So we could see scenarios where VLCCs are bought into a market used for floating storage for Iranian barrels. And that would also, I mean, once they use the dark fleet and that's full, you know, that could also absorb the older age side of the VLCC segment, which is already a very older fleet. And it would make, you know, the potential fleet growth maybe even negative, but it would make it even more attractive going forwards. So I think more likely than scrapping is, you know, some Iranian or shadow fleet use for floating storage on the basis of further sanctions.
And you touched upon the called plain vanilla feed also being quite old. But are you seeing any relaxation of the age requirements there? You know, given the fact that the fleet is aging, or is it still sort of the 18-year mark where some charterers are looking for more modern tonnage? Because I guess that when cargoes come back and if OPEC decides to unwind their production cut, that just gives, you know, makes it an even better backdrop when everything is firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, I mean, I like to be quite direct. So I think, you know, 15 years is an age where it becomes a bit more challenging to trade your assets. And 20-year mark is, other than like a very well-maintained vessel that's been with the company since delivery, you know, and it's been with one owner, I would say after 20 years old, it's very, like, I would usually never compete with an over 20-year-old ship. But of course, in a very firm market, the 15-year-old limit for, let's say, Unipec is used as a way to relieve pressure in the market, and they'll be more open to taking older ships. So, yeah, I would say that, you know, once it gets to 20 years old, and it's, you know, we don't have any competition. And from 15, you become a lot less efficient. And I think, I mean, many of these companies, I think we have as well, that we've shown, and I think you have as well in your research, you've shown that from the 15, 16, 17, 18 year age mark, how much efficiency, or like how many fewer cargoes or barrels the vessel can move per year. And that's a big effect over the next years where the fleet keeps getting older.
Kenneth, yeah, you had your hand raised on the scrapping side. You know, any other comments that are more particularly to the Afra and the Suez? I guess, you know, they are on average older than the VLCCs, so should probably see more scrapping in that segment.
Yeah, I would totally agree with the comments made by Svein and Aristides, and the numbers are significant, right? I mean, I just took a tally, and we have 277 Aframaxes and Suezmaxes that are trading in the dark or gray fleet that are over 20 years old. So to Svein's point, those vessels are most likely not in better condition today than when they entered those fleets 1 or 2 years ago. And I think this is definitely the biggest challenge we have as an industry and as a globe. We are not focusing on the biggest issues right now. I totally agree that emissions is incredibly important, that we get that right for the long term. But the biggest issue we have right now is that we have a very large percentage of tankers that are transporting oil that are not insured, that are not run to the standards that all of us on this panel would run tankers to. And that's clearly what needs the attention of IMO and the world and the US and anybody else who can pay attention or do something about it. I think that's the most important priority we have. I also agree with Aristides. I actually think we're quite agnostic whether the vessel is scrapped from a utilization and trading and a positive trade impact. We're agnostic whether the vessel is scrapped or whether it trades in the dark fleet. It doesn't compete in the markets that we compete in. But the longer that we're waiting and that the dark fleet continues to trade, obviously, we're going to have a massive challenge at the scrap yards because it is becoming a capacity issue, and it's also becoming an issue about which yards are actually allowed to trade. And I think that there is a real fear amongst all industry players that we could see these vessels just being abandoned with the keys in, and and in worst cases also with seafarers on board that have not been paid, and that's a real disaster for the collective interests of our interests here, of our industry, of course.
Well, thank you for you know, wise considerations. We are 10 minutes ahead of schedule, so I think that that sort of wraps it up. You know, what have we learned here? Perhaps that the supply side looks still very good for you know, across the crude tanker space, and that demand in China is the real trigger to come here. I want to thank all the panelists for participating today. I want to thank Capital Link for hosting this event, and hope you all have a good day and afternoon, and a happy holidays.